Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like on the surface of Mars, and what will have to happen before human explorers can make their way there in person? A great deal of what scientists have learned about past and present conditions on the Red Planet has come over the past decade, thanks to data gathered, processed, and transmitted by the Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity, with more to come pending the successful arrival of the mobile Mars Science Laboratory that launched in November. Joining us now is a key member of the team, NASA engineer Kobe Boykins, who also designed the solar arrays that powered Spirit and Opportunity. Kobe, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So, talk about this. Why is Mars so particularly important in terms of what we're doing to understand the world beyond our world?
There's a lot of reasons why I think Mars is exciting. One, it's our sister planet, or it seems that everybody thinks it's our sister planet, and that, you know, it formed about the same time as Earth did, and that it's always been one of these things in the sky that you see. It's bright, it's out there, and it's red. You know, they named it Mars, the god of war. And I think it's always enticed and excited people. And so now, as an explorer, as a scientist, as an engineer, it's interesting because we now know with Spirit and Opportunity, the rovers that were sent in 2004, that there was once water on the surface of Mars. And that opens up a great many things that you can think of and learn from Mars. And that, if you ask me personally, I think the reason it's so exciting is that it once had water, and where did that water go? And could that actually happen here on Earth? And mm-hmm. I think that brings it back home for me, which is, why do we explore it? Why do we spend money there?
And there could still be water under the surface?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, with Mars Phoenix, a mission that we sent to the poles, mm-hmm. That went down there and scooped some of the dirt and actually found water ice. So it seems like subsurface there could be water. But we know that there was once a lot of water on Mars. We just don't know what happened to it. So maybe it went subsurface, it froze. We just don't know.
Mars doesn't have a lot of gravity as compared with the Earth, but it does have an atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. It has an atmosphere, and it does have a little bit of gravity. It's about a third of that what's on here on Earth. So and the atmosphere is more or less carbon dioxide. So it's 1/100th of our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. We say 7 torr CO2, these, you know, important numbers. But it's more or less carbon dioxide instead of being a lot of more of oxygen, nitrogen, like our atmosphere and our air that we breathe.
So a lot of what we know about Mars has come certainly over the past decade, but it was like the mid-1960s, right, when we got our first really close-up look?
Yeah, the 70s when we landed with Viking. Mm-hmm. And so Viking 1, Viking 2, and then the Voyager missions that flew by and took some very interesting images, you know, and that sort of was our very first deep look into Mars. And I think that started the fascination with what's going on there. There's these geological processes, and there's these differences as we went by different places and took different images of them. And that started really, hey, what's going on the surface of Mars? You know, we can see out, it's a rocky place, it's red, it's, you know, it's cold. We sort of knew those things. But we didn't know, could it have sustained life? Could there be water there? What are the other things that we can learn from Mars? And that started a whole explosion of exploration, if you will, robotic exploration. And the Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, were more or less following the water, you know, follow the signs of water on the surface of Mars to see if in fact there was water there. And that with now Mars Science Laboratory called Curiosity on its way, the Spirit and Opportunity were geologists. Curiosity is more of a biologist. It's really looking to see if we can find signal signs, building blocks for life on the surface of Mars.
Can you describe those rover and Opportunity, how big they were and what's on board that made them so special?
Okay, well, let's start back in 97 with Pathfinder. Pathfinder, where there was a little rover called Sojourner. Mm-hmm. It's about the size of a microwave, very small. And it was really a scientific experiment, an engineering experiment to see if we could actually have a roving vehicle on the surface of Mars. So fast forward to 2003, landing in 2004, we sent the Mars Exploration Rover, Spirit and Opportunity, roving geologists. Now they had a science suite that was really to look at the rocks like a geologist would, a microimager, a thing that we called the RAT, a rock abrasion tool to move the weathering rind off the rock. We had an arm so that we could manipulate stuff and more or less some very high-end cameras. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice pictures. We can look at the images, look around, and I think that's what captures the public's eye. Now, the scientists, we have some filters so that we can take different images and look at different things. We have a alpha proton X-ray spectrometer and a Mossbauer. Okay, I won't go into the science of them, but really looking at the chemical composition of the rocks. Tells us what the rocks are made of, looking for this, following the water. And what made them so, in my opinion, what made them so successful and what so great was that people hadn't seen Mars in that way. we landed 180 degrees. You know, if you look at a globe, we were on one side and the other side. So being here in Dallas and being somewhere like in China or somewhere out in the tundra of Russia. So we were apart and we're in totally different areas. We landed in a crater, which was the Gusev crater, and we landed in the Meridiani Plains, which looks like a huge parking lot filled with dust. So, I mean, you see these different, totally different places on Mars that have a very similar story, that there was once water there, that there's different minerals, there's different things, but both telling sort of a similar story about water being there on the surface. And I think people that tuned in were amazed by, one, the fact that these things both worked and landed on the surface of Mars after this unbelievable, you know, 7 month journey where they bounce around on the surface and then unfurl and then, you know, out pops this little rover and it drives around and takes these images. That, and then the story that they've lasted so long. You know, they were only supposed to last for 90 days. And here we are 8 years later and Opportunity is still taking data and giving us back images.
That's like a fabulous warranty gone the right way.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't happen that often.
So you designed the solar arrays. How much, to what extent did they rely on those for power? And obviously they must have had regular batteries inside.
Yeah, so they do. The rovers, both rovers have batteries inside, but they actually rely solely on the solar arrays to charge those batteries. Mm-hmm. So the solar arrays are the only way we can actually take the sun's energy, convert that into power that we can use and store that in the batteries. And so, yeah, it was a very interesting thing. You know, I didn't know much about solar arrays when I started. It was sort of, hey, here's your job. Figure this out. Now, you know, the technology that we use is not built by NASA. We actually buy the solar cells. Now, the structure that holds the cells and how they deployed and all that stuff is the stuff that I got to work on. Now, I was in charge of the whole thing. But you learn a lot. It's almost like doing a PhD in solar technology by doing this design work. So it is amazing in that, you know, we never thought we would last this long. I mean, the power that we had and what we thought we were going to end up as dust accumulated on the solar cells was going to cause us to die within, let's say, 300 days, something like that. Or we would be where we were power negative, where we weren't actually, you know, storing enough energy from the sun to continue to work. And that we've been very lucky. And, you know, the driving on the surfaces at certain slopes and maybe these dust devils that we've caught on video have helped us, you know, remove some of the dust from the solar rays every once in a while. And then we go into winter, we actually hibernate. So the rover actually gets to, you know, be more like a banker. I'm trying to make fun of somebody, but, you know, it wakes up at 10:30 and goes to sleep at 3:30. So it doesn't really spend a whole day working either.
So there's no way to attach something that would clean off those solar cells?
There was. Actually, and we had some different ideas. It's just the technology readiness at the time we were going to launch wasn't really there. And so I had always wanted to just lift the solar arrays because we really don't know how the dust actually adheres to the solar cells. And so one of the things was, oh, if we just lift the solar arrays, will the dust roll off?
Yeah.
And that, you know, how does it bind itself? And we just didn't get to do that. One, because the actuators that actually deployed the solar arrays during the entry, descent, and landing phase, what we call EDL, were actually cut from the lander. The power actually came from the landed system, and they weren't actually powered from the rover itself. So we actually couldn't do that. And so they made me latch it out, which made me very angry. But, you know, it was one of those engineering, you know, experiments that I wanted to do, but, you know, it ran a big risk as well.
There's got to be, and I know you work well with your teammates, but there's got to be a lot of occasionally some tension when people are so passionate about these projects and you're sure you know the right way to do it.
Yeah, that's the fun part, though, is that you get to work with some of the brightest minds in the world, and that the technical arguments that you're making are not about, oh, I think you're wrong or I think you're right. It's what is the best technical answer for the hardware that we're going to send to this other planet. And so most of the times when you have those, you when cooler heads prevail, when you're not just trying to argue your point, but you're actually looking through and going through the basic physics of it, and you say, you know what, that really is the right answer. And that, you know, there's this underlying thing, which is the mathematics and the physics of the universe sort of dictate what we're going to do. And so a lot of times we end up just right back there, which is, okay, what is the physics of the universe? And does that help us with this story? And that you are passionate. You're working with people who have a very, very narrow, focused goal, and that's to explore the surface of Mars. And that helps in a lot of ways because you're arguing and you're passionate about arguing for the thing that you're trying to do, which is get the best scientific data that we can from the surface of the red planet and bring that back to help the scientists and the engineers learn more about that planet. So it's good.
I guess scientists find ways to work together in a variety of situations, but this question has never occurred to me before. Is there like an HR training team at NASA that finds ways to get people kind of on the same page?
I wish there were. I don't think there. I mean, you know, it's funny that you asked that question. I've never had the training that says, okay, here's how you work with other engineers, right? We tend to be very interesting group of people, you know, and we span the gamut. If anybody watches the Big Bang Theory, you know, you see a lot of different variety of people. But I think that when you have a narrow focus goal, you know, when you're all driving toward a goal that's very, very in front of you and you have good requirements, you know, you're saying, hey, we're going to follow the water. These are the science instruments that we're going to have. Here's the budget that we have to live in. Here's the volume and the mass. You have some boundaries. And then you can really start to focus in and get to the best design that you can come up with and then deliver that to the surface. So, I mean, yeah, the arguments happen. And I think that you work ways out and that most of the language that we use is physics, mm-hmm. math, and science. So, you know, that's sort of it's a law, right? It's hard numbers. And you can do that across boundaries of age. You can do it across boundaries of ethnicity. You can do it about, you know, of where you're born and even language. And so I think that's the great equalizer in terms of those arguments is that you're coming back to the fundamentals of what's going on.
Talk a little bit about what happens. You launch these things and they land, and how are they extricated from the vehicle that delivered them and put into action?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So we come in a lander. Inside the lander, we're in a back shell and a heat shield, and we're doing a lot of different separation devices. And more or less how they're extricated from those is we use pyrotechnic devices. So more or less...
You're blowing them out of there.
Yeah, we're blowing them out, right? There's little pieces, you know, if you think about it, little charges that actually blow up and they push things away with springs and different mechanisms. So we move our heat shield away, we move a back shell away, we land the lander inside this huge thing of airbags, at least for Spirit and Opportunity. We pull those airbags in with an actuator, a motor, and a gearbox that has a cable that pulls that stuff taut. We open up the lander pedals. Now this takes a long time, about 45 minutes, but they open up the lander and that exposes our rover, and our rover is held to the lander deck with pyrotechnic devices. So we blow those and then we stand the rover up. And then, you know, 12 days later, if you look at Spirit, then we figure out, oh, how do we drive off the lander and just get six wheels on the surface? Mm-hmm. And so it's a long series of things that has to happen, somewhere like around 86 different separation events. So you can start to think, ooh, that has to be really, really reliable to do it, you know, successfully and do it successfully twice. And so it's interesting, you know, how you get these things off. And once the rover stands up, you still have to figure out how to get off the lander, which was very difficult. So we, as engineers, we do a lot of testing.
Why is that so hard?
Well, you're on a different planet, and you don't know exactly how you're going to land and what orientation you're going to land. Right? So the rover's set down, and it can drive forward or backwards. And that's, you know, in general, okay, that's great. But if you land in forwards, there's a rock, and backwards, there's a rock. Well, how do you get off the lander? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to turn in place. So now you have to turn on the lander, and you have to make sure you don't snag on something that we've put there. And so there's a lot of consideration. And one of the things that we were able to do, luckily, on this mission is have built five different rovers. We flew, you know, Spirit and Opportunity, but we had some test vehicles that we had back here on Earth at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And we could actually use those vehicles to do some of the testing of what we saw on the surface of Mars. So if we saw a rock that was in our way when we were trying to get off the lander, we could actually build that situation. Mm-hmm. We could actually take our images, build it, and then test how we're going to actually drive off. And that, you know, taking a step of 2 feet seems easy to us, right? We can just do it because we have eyes and we have a mobility system and we have a brain that closes the loop for everything. But the rover doesn't have that. The rover has, you know, the humans, and the humans are saying, okay, you can drive off that. But if we told it to drive off the cliff, it would just drive off the cliff. It mm-hmm. wouldn't know any better. Now, it has a little bit of smarts, but it doesn't have a lot. So we have to be smart enough to say, okay, you're going to drive off this cliff and you're going to be safe. And that when you're, you know, spending taxpayer money to do this exploration, you want to make sure it's safe. So that's one of the things we'll do. We'll do a lot of testing before we do those types of things.
My guest this hour is NASA engineer Kobe Boykins.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NASA engineer Kobe Boykins. He has worked on the Mars rover projects and is now working on the Mars Science Laboratory. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Kobe, before you launch these things, there's this frenzy of activity and there's testing and there's arguing and there's finding the exact right way to do this. And then you put it into space and then you wait.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It's almost the best feeling ever because, you know, we launch on these solid rockets and once they light them, we call it lighting the candle. Once mm-hmm. they light the candle, there's nothing else you can do. I mean, as a mechanical engineer, we can still upload software so we can change some things and how the vehicle thinks and how it reacts to certain things. But in general, as a mechanical guy, you can't touch it anymore. It's gone. Mm-hmm. So all the arguments stop, right?
Yeah.
Now it's just figuring out how it's going to work. And sometimes we actually figure out exactly how we're going to drive it or how we're going to move and what its capabilities are after we've launched.
Really?
Now, we will do some of the testing mm-hmm. before and we'll want to know all those things. But usually what will happen is that as you land, you take an image, you get this beautiful panoramic image. And now you say, okay, this is a little different than what we were testing. Mm-hmm. We need to go back and do some more testing. Oh, the rocks are a little bit bigger. Are there this type of rock versus that type of rock? The soil's a little bit softer. It's a little bit harder. It doesn't have the same cohesion. Whatever it is, you're going to actually go back and you might do some more work to inform what you're going to do on the surface of Mars. So while you're waiting, that 7 months, what we call the quiescent period, a lot of stuff is going on. It's a frenzy of activity still. It's just not as much mechanical. It's more of the, how are we going to operate this vehicle?
Is there a little part of you as an engineer that sort of hopes that problems will crop up that you didn't expect, or challenges, I should say?
Yeah. I mean, that's the best part of being an engineer, is coming up with cool answers to mm-hmm. things like that. No, you don't hope for that stuff, but it's almost like, you know, when you were in kindergarten or first grade and you turned in your first assignment and you were so worried that something was going to go wrong, mm-hmm. you hope that that doesn't happen. And you're like, I hope nothing goes wrong, because you don't want anybody to blame you. And then you sort of go, well, it'd be really nice to have to fix something. maybe something should go wrong. And it's like, maybe Joe's stuff should have a problem. Not my stuff, but Joe's stuff. And I'll help Joe fix his issues.
Figure it all out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want there to be problems because, mm-hmm. one, you've done the testing and you feel real confident. We want everything to work perfectly. But you know things are going to come up. And that's when you really get a chance to shine, is when things actually go a little wrong. It's how do you come up with creative ways to work around those issues? You know, and now with a vehicle that's, let's say, old for, you know, the surface of Mars in terms of Spirit and Opportunity, Spirit stopped communicating. It had its problems. You know, there was a heater that was stuck on when it landed and it had one of the actuators, one of the wheels stopped turning very well. So we just drug it, you know, and mm-hmm. it was like, oh, that works great. And it, you know, it was a scientific thing that happened, was like by dragging and making these trenches, we actually learned a lot more about the soil we were running over.
Because you're churning it up.
Yeah, we mm-hmm. were churning it up and we saw this difference in salinity. And that sort of started to tell us a story, at least in the Gusev Crater for Spirit's landing site, was that, oh, this is telling us something. And this change in salinity as we're moving up the Husband Hill, named after Columbia astronauts, we were learning something. And that change in salinity actually gave us one of the big pieces to say, oh, hey, there was once water here in this area on the surface of Mars.
And the idea is maybe oceans on Mars?
Yeah, maybe not so deep. Maybe mm-hmm. not, you know, tens of, you know, meters deep, maybe a few inches deep. But, you know, yeah, oceans, big, large bodies of water. You know, it seems very interesting. I can't wait to get all the rest of the information, learn more about Mars.
So tell me about the Science Laboratory and what it can do that Spirit and Opportunity could not.
Okay, so the Mars Science Laboratory is a much bigger vehicle, just in sense of scale and size. So if Spirit and Opportunity are the size of, let's say, and you asked me this earlier, a coffee table. Mm-hmm. They're 5'2" from front to back, and they're 7'2", I like to say, Shaquille O'Neal from the wings of the solar arrays. And so they're big, but they're like a coffee table size. The Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity, is the size of a small car, mm-hmm. So much bigger vehicle, designed to do a little bit different things. Spirit and Opportunity, roving geologist. Mars Science Laboratory, more like a roving biologist, more science instruments. We're actually going to drill the surface and actually take dirt, dust, rocks, samples, ingest them into the vehicle, bring them inside the laboratory and do science, in situ science on them within our two big science instruments inside the vehicle. So there's an instrument called SAM, can't remember the acronym, and then there's another one called KEMIN, can't remember the acronym, but both of them looking at the chemical composition of the rock and what actually could be there, and does it have the building blocks for life? That's one of our scents. This has a much more capable arm, much bigger arm. The arm's about 2 meters long, 6 feet, has a lot of different instruments on it, nice microimager, the drill, this whole thing that we call SASPA, the Sample Acquisition, Sample Processing and Handling System. I love these acronyms. And then we actually have inside the our mast, which is what we call the remote sensing mast, where we take some pictures from where our eyes are, we have a laser. And so that laser can actually fire at rocks, which is the coolest thing for me. We can fire at rocks and literally burn them. And then we can look at the gas that comes out, and we can analyze that gas to see what the rock is made of instead of actually having to go over and touch it. So it's a much more capable vehicle in terms of its science suite, and can tell a story that's more complete in terms of, can we sustain or does it exist the biological material building blocks to support life?
Since you're looking for life, is there any need to sterilize these vehicles before they leave
they
the
are.
Earth?
Yeah, most definitely. There's a whole world of within JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and NASA called planetary protection. And so before the vehicle leaves, we actually bake the whole vehicle. Mm-hmm. Every single part is baked, and then we wipe it down, and then we actually sample it to see how many spores are on there, how many spores are alive, how many spores are dead, are they viable, can they grow? And so we actually have a count that we have to meet, and that count's very low, of how many spores can actually be alive on the vehicle before we launch. And so that's controlled by international law, and so we actually have to do that. So yeah, the vehicle's baked out very, very well, and the Planetary Protection Officer for the United States manages and watches over everything that we're doing there.
There's a Planetary Protection Officer for the United States. What a job.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You get to sit there and look at bugs all day. And it's sort of fun because it's an interesting part of the science, which is, you know, how do you actually sterilize something? How do you clean it to go to another planet? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as we look forward in our Mars program to doing a Mars sample return, how do we make sure that we don't bring anything back, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to kill everything that we have. We want to have a viable sample, but how do we make sure that that doesn't leak out and get, you know, infect everybody and the Andromeda strain and those types of movies? So, it's a very interesting science part of doing exploration of planetary bodies is how do you make sure that you don't contaminate them and how do you make sure that they don't contaminate you?
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Tim on the line in Parker. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Chris. Nice show. I'm enjoying it. The question I have is that back in the days when the first lander was there, the Viking, I believe, it took a sample from the soil, reacted it inside a chemical lab thing, and it said it gave the right results for life being on Mars. I'll take my answer off the radio.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting. And we've gone back and we've looked at some of those instruments that we had on Viking, and that you could have possibly put a bone inside there and it wouldn't have known. It wasn't the very, in today's, you know, technological world, it wasn't very sensitive, and that we may have had some false positives and we may have some false negatives. I mean, Viking was a very amazing mission in and of itself, and that we learned a lot about the surface of Mars. We learned a lot about the distribution of rocks on Mars, but I don't think it was a great biological mission, and that now with the Mars Science Laboratory, we've had, 30 years of, improvements in our electronics. Not to say that that was a bad mission. It was a great mission, and that had we been able to substantiate some of the data that we had gotten in the science community, it would have been fantastic. But I think that that's still sort of out there. It's still some of these things that nobody's ever been able to answer, is that, oh, yeah, did we really find biological material or not? And I think that was one of the weaknesses of Viking as a whole. It was a great mission, but that was one of the weaknesses, is that the instrument suite wasn't strong enough, if you will, to give all the answers that we would have liked to get.
We have an email here. This one comes from Tom in Fort Worth, who wants to know, how abrasive is the Martian dust on the surface of the solar panels?
Oh, well, I wish we could actually go back and look. I mean, one of the things that it's hard to actually ascertain from the pictures is how abrasive is the dust that's there. I mean, it's more like iron, dust rust that's floating around in the surface, and that the solar cells are covered with glass. Mm-hmm. And so the glass is, in this case, I think it's about 4 mils thick. We can't really tell by looking at the images. I mean, we know that there's a lot of dust on the surface that has been accumulated, but we haven't been able to actually, and we know the dust is magnetic because we put a little couple magnets there to catch the dust, but we don't really know how abrasive it is. And that is an actually interesting experiment that maybe we want to think of for the next one. Now that I'm thinking about it, we've just really never done that. We know that it does wear away at our wheels, not at a very high rate. So we could probably do some inferring of how, abrasive it is. We just don't have a good answer.
So the thought all along has been the more we learn about Mars, the more prepared we can be to have human beings actually land on the planet. First of all, before we talk about the viability of such a project, what could humans do that not the very best robotic technology can accomplish?
And it's sort of ethereal, mm-hmm. that there's nothing like having a human being tell you what it's like to be somewhere. A robot can never do that. It can send you images. It can sort of tell you what the temperature is. It's cold, right? I mean, you can personify a rover all you want to, right? Spirit and Opportunity, they seem like my little children. It's great. But it's nothing like having a human being standing there and saying, you should see the sunset on the surface of Mars, mm-hmm. right? I just don't think there's anything that's ever going to be tangible that you can say, right? Robots can do most of the things that we would do with a human being cheaper. Right. But having a human being there, they have the intellectual thought, which goes, oh, this is a rock that everybody thinks I should go to. But this rock right next to it is the rock that I should pick up. Mm-hmm. And you just can't make that decision with a robot. So that's why I think we're going to end up with human beings there. I think that's the thing that a human being can do that a robot can never do. A human being can come back and inspire the next generation of explorers. A robot can't do that. Right? He can't sit there and tell you. I mean, it would be great to have Wall-E, right? I mean, Wall-E comes back and says, hey, look, you should do this. I mean, it would be fantastic. But I don't think that happens. And that, you have a human being that stood there and can turn around and talk to somebody and say, I was there and this is what it was like and here's what we saw. And that changes people in a way that I don't think you can get from a vehicle, a robotic mission. And I'm a robotics guy, right? I mean, but I think that's why you look at, paving the way for a human being to be there, because I think that's the goal for us. I mean, this curiosity, and that's why I love the name of our next rover, this curiosity that we have, this burning desire to explore, is what drives us. And that by having a human being out there is going to expand the way we think about our solar system and our world, our universe.
So at the time when we are ready to start making plans, what do? Do we send equipment and supplies ahead
of
human beings? And how far out does that work? And how do you make sure this stuff lasts?
See that? Well, that's a very good question. You're asking all the questions that we should be, we've been working on this problem. I'd say NASA in general has been working on this problem. I don't do a lot of stuff with the man side. Mm-hmm. I'm a robotics guy. So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory does a lot of robotic space exploration.
Right. But I'm sure in the cafeteria, you guys have these conversations.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, the biggest thing is to find water, mm-hmm. right? If we find water, now we have at least a source of oxygen, mm-hmm. and we have a source of, water, supply, drink, and we have fuel because we can separate the oxygen, hydrogen, and burn both to get back to Earth. So that's a huge thing for us. And yeah, definitely we'd have to send some supplies out in front. We would have to do a robotic precursor missions to prepare for human beings to come in there. Like we would, think about it. You would land something and create an infrastructure. Like there would be a, some place to live and maybe a toilet and, some kind of communication, some way to, you could have a robot do all of that. And now when you land, you have to land in a certain area. Now the human beings don't have to necessarily fight the harsh environment. They can get into a place that's shelter.
It's like a freeway rest stop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You could think of it just like that. And so we need that. And so, I mean, those are some of the precursor missions that will have to occur before a human gets there. And how long out before the human shows up? Well, that's a good question, right? I mean, the materials don't decay that fast on the surface of Mars. The rovers being there for 8 years sort of shows us that. Would food last? Well, it depends. Everybody knows NASA for Tang. I think Tang would be okay. Maybe we'll fly some Twinkies too. They'll be all right. But I don't know. I don't know what the answers are to those things. And I think some of that helps that we're continuing a human presence in the International Space Station, and that we can learn some of these things that we're going to need to do a deep space mission, and that, having a lunar base may help as well. It's just training grounds for going even deeper into space.
40 years ago, the idea was that each country would sort of do it on its own and be the victor. Are we better off making almost every project now an international effort?
I think we're going to have to end up there. I mean, it's funny. This is one of those other questions that has to do with me just being a space geek. But, you look at what happened for Star Trek, and that was everybody coming together. I don't think that any country can afford to foot the bill all by themselves anymore. And that international collaboration actually makes it better because you get different ideas, you get different goals, you get different views of the same type of topic. And that helps. Now, I mean, the U.S. is in my opinion, will always be one of the leaders, and that it's very difficult for us to, you know, give away a lot of our technology to some of the other countries. And that's important for us, and that makes sense to me. But to have international collaboration on a deep space mission like going to Mars is, I think, the only way we're actually going to be able to afford it.
I read that you were inspired as a kid by watching Star Trek, but not the Captain Kirk Star Trek. You were a Jean-Luc Picard generation.
Yeah, I mean, I do like the Captain Kirk. There's no question I like the original. But the reason I like Jean-Luc Picard is because they had Geordi LaForge, right? Yeah. Here's LeVar Burton, a guy that I knew from reading Rainbow when I was a kid, and he was the engineer, right? He was the guy that made everything go. And I liked Scotty, there's no question. But here's somebody I could identify with, you know, as being an African-American in TV. And I was like, that's the guy I want to be. I want to be just like that. Now, I didn't want to wear a Fram filter on my face and walk around. But, I mean, I wanted to be that guy. And so, and I thought Jean-Luc Picard was really cool because he would always ask for Earl Grey tea, you know, Earl Grey hot. You know, I thought it was so cool. But, you know, I mean, I loved Star Trek. I love the stories and that, you know, now being a little older, I can go back and watch some of the original series and really understand that it was more of a political satire than it was just a space story. You know, there's a lot of technology in there, but it was really a pretty, you know, in your face, you know, political satire as well. So, I mean, and I love it for that. And that, you know, it really inspired me to do the type of work that I'm doing now, which is to do robotic exploration of space and build the vehicles that do that. And there's nothing like, you know, science fiction becoming science fact. And it's amazing that it happens so often.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Derek on the line in Granbury. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Hey, this is taking me back a little bit. I had the pleasure of working on the Viking Mission to Mars program with Martin Marietta back in 1974.
Wow.
Of course, we landed in 76. Kobe made an interesting comment about batteries versus photovoltaic cells. At that time, we were using radioisotopic generators. I just wonder if they are not allowed anymore in deep space missions.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. In fact, if you look at what's powering the Mars Science Laboratory, you'll see that we're using a variation of your RTGs that you guys used back in Viking. So we're back to nuclear source to power that vehicle, mostly because we want it to be a two-year mission and we want to actually do some science at night, which the photovoltaics don't necessarily allow.
NASA engineer Kobe Borkins is with us. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NASA engineer Kobe Borkins. He has worked on Mars exploration projects. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And that's where we hear from Steve in Dallas, who wants to know if the rovers have hearing capability.
Yeah, both Spirit and Opportunity actually had the ability to actually listen, like a microphone. Now, we didn't actually use it. They actually used IMU and small vibrations to actually make sound. So there's a couple things that you can actually download from the JPL website, and that you can actually hear the sounds of Mars. And it's more or less like the driving on the surface and looking at the vibrations and then converting that into a sound. Mars Science Laboratory actually has another microphone that we're flying. Just like we did on Pathfinder, we had another microphone that you could actually listen to the wind blow by and things like that.
Why are the volcanoes on Mars so different from the ones here?
I don't think they are.
Are they not?
No, not really. I mean, now Olympus Mons is huge compared to that.
It's like the biggest in the solar system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's the size of Arizona, right? It's the biggest volcano. But I don't think volcanically they're the same. I mean, the rock is that they shoot out is the same. Now, right now, most of the volcanoes, at least in my opinion, I think all the volcanoes on Mars are dead because there's no active core. So the liquid core that we would have here on Earth, that's the magma that's moving around that leaks out every once in a while to relieve pressure, they don't have that on Mars anymore. It's cooled down. And so, or that's the theory. And so the mountains or the volcanoes look the same. They just are, they're just not active.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Mark in Colleyville. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris. I want to tell you I really enjoy your show, and I have a question for your guest, Kobe. My nephew works for Lockheed Martin, and I'm curious about the navigation that NASA employs to get their spacecraft from point A to point B. Is it space-based, vehicle-based, earth-based, or a combination of those? And who is responsible for actually doing that?
Good question. So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory runs the Deep Space Network for NASA, which is a series of large dishes that are spread out around the Earth to communicate to the vehicles that are flying. And so Lockheed Martin, Ball, Aerospace, TRW, all of the big names in aerospace that do fly spacecraft that go deep space, usually managed by JPL but built by other companies, are flown by NASA JPL. Now, that doesn't mean we get all the data that comes down. Sometimes we get data that goes through different places, but we actually fly the spacecraft. And it's both space-based and Earth-based. Some of the vehicles that we have that orbit Earth can actually, relay information. But for the most part, we try to do it all via Earth-based, these big, large dishes that we have from the Deep Space Network. And it's always great to hear people. I mean, I was just thinking about the last caller, two callers ago, that was saying that he worked or was working on Viking. I mean, it's the footsteps of giants that did those types of things that we build on. And I'm always honored to hear people that got to work on those amazing missions, because, I mean, we still use the technology that they learned, for Viking 1, Viking 2 today. And that's how we learn about Mars and how we keep building as engineers.
Well, you're still a very young person, but I wonder if you are envious of people who will live five generations from now.
Yeah, very. I'm very happy that I'm living where I'm living, mm-hmm. but I'm very envious. I mean, I think to myself of the changes that I've seen, right? And I am a young person, I guess, and I appreciate that. But, I see those changes and I go, wow, what's the next generation going to have? What are they going to be able to do? What's the generation after that going to be able to have and what are they going to be able to achieve and do? And sometimes I get jealous, and sometimes I get nervous, and sometimes I get worried, mm-hmm. because I worry that we don't have as many people that are into the science, mathematics, engineering, technology areas, and that we're falling behind as a country and globally. And that worries me because, when I was in school, maybe it wasn't cool to be a nerd, but the guys and the young women that were doing that were focused, dedicated. It wasn't about, going home and playing the video games and whatever else. It was really about trying to expand our knowledge and the knowledge base. And so I would love to live five, generations from now, but I'm really happy that I'm right now, because I think that the things that kids have that are distractions are just as great. And so I don't know. I mean, it would be awesome to see somebody invent warp drive, at the end of my career. And, now 5 years, 50 years, 100 years, 500 years from now, people are, able to zap themselves wherever they want. There's a colony on the moon. There's a colony on Mars. There's, people living on Europa and Io and Enceladus, all these other different, planetary bodies. I don't think they could live on Jupiter. Gravity is too high. But, I think that would be amazing to see how much the technology advances from, today for another 500 years.
What do we talk about some of the practical applications for the technologies that you're working on, that your colleagues are working on? Because on this show, we tend to have a lot of people who are very pro investment in exploration and science. But there are a lot of other people who say, look, we got plenty of problems on terra firma.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to say, oh, this is exactly what's going to come out. Right. If we understood what the invention was going to be, we would be millionaires or billionaires by now. Now, there's a lot of things that have occurred and will continue to occur, right? The algorithms that we use to communicate are the ones you use in your cell phone, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of that technology is amplified, helped, brought forward through the stuff that we do in NASA and talking to deep space, spacecraft. For the remote sensing that we're doing, a lot of the remote sensing that we're going to do with Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity, we're going to learn a lot about how we do remote, biology, remote geology, how we actually drill in a dry environment. There's probably a lot of people in the oil industry out here. They know very well how to get deep and how to drill with a wet slurry. But we're drilling dry with no water, no lubrication, no slurry at all. So we're going to learn a lot about that kind of thing and how we can actually use that for maybe applications here on Earth. I don't know. that we might find something out that we can use. How we actually transmit and move dirt is one of the biggest things that we have, right? How do you move dirt in robotic sense? How do you robotically do a lot of things? And that, you know, the grand challenge that NASA has every year where they're trying to drive across the desert, you know, unmanned vehicle driving across the desert. I think that has applications for, you know, the future of the Jetson vehicle or the car that can drive itself. So I think that you're starting to see the precursors and how we actually commercialize some of that stuff. I mean, a lot of times we turn over the technology and we don't know exactly how it's going to be commercialized. But we hope that there's lots of different applications that we can go on, and I'm just guessing at a few.
The other focus of your career has been ocean mapping.
One of the missions I've worked on, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so talk about the, are there similarities? And so you're doing this with satellites, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's a series of satellites that that we've worked with NOAA, and it's usually, this is the true international mission, which is the mission I worked on was called JASON. And there's JASON 1, JASON 2, and now JASON 3. There's TOPEX, Poseidon, those EOS. These are all ocean mappers, more or less. And they're looking at the height of the ocean. They're looking at the salinity content. They're looking at different parts of the ocean to tell temperature, current, et cetera. And, there's different applications. So, I mean, you know, engineering is engineering at some level, the basic physics. And that, you know, as much as I love to talk about Mars and I'd like to talk about Venus, I love that we actually look at back here at home, too. And we try to do things and we try to look for ways that can help all of us here on Earth right now. And so with these ocean mappers, and we're looking at La Nina, El Nino, weather patterns, and that one of the things that the scientists are always talking about is getting coastal approach. You know, from space, you can get pretty close to the surface of the coast, but you can't get that close. I'm 15 miles. And if we can get within, let's say, 2 miles, now we can actually do better weather prediction. You know, you can start to see weather patterns and how the surface currents that are happening in the oceans are actually affecting weather. And so there's all this technology that's learning about prediction. I mean, I know, you know, just looking at the news this morning of these big tornadoes that are occurring, you know, and that I'm not saying that we could do this, but having a better prediction methodology, you know, I mean, I grew up in Nebraska, you know, I mean, I just remember, you know, you get maybe 3 minutes of early warning, you know, somebody sees a funnel cloud and they call it in and then you're running to jump in the basement to, you know, to protect yourself. And so, I mean, you know, that thing's close to my heart growing up sort of here in the Midwest. So, I mean, I think that those types of things are things that we want to continue to do and continue to study in terms of a robotic exploration of our own planet. And that, you know, I like to go underneath the ocean as well. I mean, we've built a couple vehicles that have gone down to try to, you know, study the underwater femorals, these underwater gas giant or smokers that are, you know, more or less holes into the, you know, magma where the, you know, the Earth is coming out. So, I think all of those things come together as a holistic part of what we can do as an engineering community and, you know, under the guise of NASA to learn and to explore and to use our unique talents to do different things.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hey, Mike.
Yes, Chris, another great show.
Thank
Always
you.
Impressed. Yes, sir. My question is, you mentioned a few moments ago that it's an observation of yours that you notice that there's not as much interest in science and technology in the schools and maybe not enough emphasis of that in curriculums. Are you familiar with the Georgia Tech partnership with NASA, which is the Electronic Professional Development Program? And if you are, aware of that, do you have any interest in that as a scientist?
So I guess I would say, first off, I don't know about Georgia Tech's outreach with NASA. I mean, we have a lot of different schools that we do outreach with. I do know that Bobby Braun was the instructor at Georgia Tech for what we call entry, descent, and landing. And he served for NASA for a while as the head of our technology program. And so he just stepped down just recently. And so we have a pretty good relationship with Georgia Tech in general at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And that there's quite a few different programs that NASA works with schools and students to fulfill one of our charter, you know, things, which is to inspire the next generation. And so that's one of the reasons I like to go out and talk to students and talk to people as well, is to try to bring my enthusiasm. Hopefully I do that. My enthusiasm for this job and doing science, technology, engineering, and mathematics to the students, like I'm doing here with some of the teachers and the students with the Geotech Conference at Bishop High School. So, I mean, those types of things I'm always trying to do. But we have a lot of different programs that we do. There's a NASA Space Grant that works with teachers that become you know, consortium parts of NASA, and the teachers get training through NASA programs and learn about NASA, you know, different NASA programs and how to teach that back in their schools. I work with National Geographic as well as a speaker for them, and they have an educational program called JASON that I've been part of and been a guest researcher twice now for different curriculum that they do for 5th through 8th grades, even up to 9th graders. So, I mean, there's a lot of us that actually go out even on our own time and try to work with schools and different places to help push that. I just don't see, and you're absolutely right. I mean, we try to do that, but I still see that we're not grabbing as many students as I would like to.
Well, talk about this, Kobe, because there are incredibly cool jobs in the world. Very few of them are also easy jobs. And I wonder, you know, you go to talk to a bunch of kids and they're very excited to see you. And then at some point they come up against it. It is challenging in a good way, but it is challenging to get to where you are.
There's no question. This is a hard job. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to get to where I am and that, you know, it doesn't happen for everybody. And that I'm very lucky in a way that I found something that I love to do and I get to do it for my job. You know, I mean,
that's how I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you hear that, you know, oh, find the thing that you love to do and do it for your job and you'll never work a day in your life. I don't feel like I get to work, you know, I have to work that often. I mean, paperwork sucks, but other than that, it's a very difficult thing. You tell the kids that if you have the drive and if you have the goal to do this, you can do it. But it's not just, oh, somebody's going to give it to you. You have to go out there and get it. And I was just talking to another National Geographic Explorer today, and we were talking about how, yeah, this job is hard. Doing what I do is hard, and it just doesn't come easy. And I failed a lot before I got to where I am. But it was those failures and me learning from those failures that built up where I became and how I got to the job that I'm in now. And so sometimes it's even okay to fail, and that we have to remember and realize that sometimes, hey, you're gonna you know, push the broom around for a while before you get to build the broom. And that's okay, because that's a learning experience. And how do you grow from that? And how do you continue to challenge yourself so that you get that job that you really want?
Are you still a guy who takes stuff apart when
yes.
you first... Are you really?
Yeah. You know, my mom doesn't let me come home that often because she knows I'm going to take her TV apart. Yeah, I still love to take things apart and see how they work. I don't know if my wife likes that much, but
Does she literally come home and find the microwave in pieces? Or
not yet. We did get a new microwave, and I'm thinking about it. But no, I love to see how things work, and I love to see what people are doing, and that just understanding how other people do their job. You know, I mean, reverse engineering in that sense is just a great way of learning. And at some level, I think it's sort of saying, hey, I think what you did is very cool. I want to learn how you did it. And that's one of the things that I've always, my mom would say that I've always done, but I've always tried to learn. And that, you know, sometimes the best way to learn is to take something apart and then figure out how to put it back together. You know, I mean, I love my wife. She's crazy. She took apart the remote control, right? Because I wasn't home and I needed to change out the screen on the remote control. So she just changed it. And she says, oh, I did it. It was actually easier than I thought it was going to be. And I said, see, it's fun. You know, there's some pieces loose in the remote control now, but that's okay. I'll fix that one of these days.
Kobe Voykins is a NASA engineer in town for Bishop Dunn High School's Geotech Conference. Kobe, it's been a pleasure. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. And it's been great to talk to all the callers.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.